Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 48, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And here we are, into the first episode of December.
God, we've been doing it this long and we haven't missed one, Dan.
I know, the show nearly an entire year old.
Oh, God.
And are you feeling festive yet?
I've been getting my presents and I've been getting Frozen going out, so yeah.
You've been watching Frozen the movie then?
No.
You don't have the type, Ravi.
God, no, I've actually played Olaf on stage once. I got pulled into a charity event and they were like, "You're Olaf." I was like, "I don't know what Olaf does. I've never seen this."
He lied.
Yeah.
So we are going to be talking about, for me, being a kid, it was always the time when you got new consoles and new computers and stuff like that. So in a bit, we are going to be talking about some of our favourite games to play at Christmas time, which now we're into the festive season.
Yeah, and you know, there's kind of games that you always feel a bit traditional with, and you know, it's always nice to play at Christmas.
Exactly, yeah. The only time of year you play some games, isn't it?
Yeah, true.
So we'll talk more about that in just a minute. And of course, every week on the Retro Hour, we bring you a guest who is an absolute legend in the world of video games. And this week, we're talking Core Design, Bubba and Sticks, Rick Dangerous, a guy who wrote his first video game when he was at school.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of the games he did kind of have influenced other games, like Rick Dangerous. A lot of people say that's Lara's dad.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Well, Core Design, it was Derby, it was all around here, wasn't it? And actually, he used to work in a video game shop in the 80s, so there's actually a really interesting bit coming up where he talks about what it was like to have a Saturday job in a video game shop in the 80s. And we are talking about Simon Phipps.
Yeah, Simon Phipps of Bugbo and Sticks.
Exactly. So he's going to be coming on the Retro Hour in around 20 minutes from now. Really good interview this week. Definitely worth hanging around for that one. And also, the Retro Hour would not be possible without your very generous support. Now, every week, we do mention there is a little PayPal link on the front page of our website, theretrohour.com. This is not a Patreon. It's not like a crowdfund or anything like that. Think of it as a little tip jar. So, you know, if you like the show, drop a couple of quid in there. It all goes into the running of it and makes us, be able to continue doing the show throughout 2017.
Yeah, cover stuff like server costs and, you know, kind of SoundCloud subscription. And
all that stuff that adds up.
Yep.
So thank you so much to this week's donators, Stuart Thomas, Manuel Sharfrey, and Simon Pilgrim, who've all made really generous donations. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, that's all at theretrohour.com.
Right then, before we get into Simon Phipps, some really good stories this week. Now, we'll start with a little device I've quite fancied getting my hands on ever since I saw it in an AVGN video. And this is called the Retro Trio.
Okay.
And what this is, it's actually not the most exciting product to talk about, a power supply.
Oh, yes, power supply.
PSU, woo! Yeah. But this essentially means that you can power your Sega Mega Drive, your Mega CD, and your 32X all from one plug.
Oh, okay. Well, these are separate before then, because I've not got these systems done, so...
Oh, they all need their own plugs.
You've got 40 systems at home. How many different adapters and plugs must you have?
Well, this is why this is quite interesting to me, because I've actually, in my office, you know, I didn't have enough screens. I've only got about 10.
Yeah.
So I put another one on the wall, and then I put a Chromecast in there as well. Look, and I thought, oh, I've run out of plugs. I've got nowhere to plug them in now. And I've got my Sega Mega Drive and Mega CD plugged into like a tower unit thing, you know, that holds like 10 plugs.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Your big surge protector, yeah.
They're all surge protected, and I turn them off before I go away, obviously, or I'm going to burn the house down.
You're draining the whole power for the whole block.
But the thing is, though, I mean, you know, people look at that and they get like, you know, it's not really the dumb thing to do to have multi-blocks plugged into other ones or even these 10 tower things, you know. Yeah. Qualified electricians would be like, you know, we should never use those kind of things. But really, I think as long as you don't have everything turned on at once.
Yeah.
You know, you can have like 10 things plugged in, and if only two are on, it's no real worse on the power supply. I live in a modern house, so, you know, it's all fuse protected and all that. But this comes in because I had to unplug my Mega Drive and Mega CD to plug this TV in. And I thought, oh, if only they had the same power supply, it would have been a lot easier.
So this
thing actually overcomes that. And annoyingly, the original power supplies on the Mega CD and the Mega Drive are those, you know, big bricks that are on the plug.
Oh, yeah. Those massive ones. Like, so is this a separate company then? Or are they, like, done a Kickstarter?
This is actually just a third-party product that got launched. It's been around for a few years. The reason it's made the news again recently is that actually it was quite hard to get hold of. A couple of suppliers, there's one in America, I forget the name off the top of my head, but they got them in stock last week, and they sold out in about 3 hours.
Wow, so, okay. Like, so
there's a demand for these things.
Yeah, definitely.
And apparently there's going to be more stock of them made very soon. So I've actually linked to, there's a website called RetroCDPowered.com, and they're kind of a European and UK supplier. And I heard they're expecting some more stock of it very soon. So.
Well, also, a lot of people buy consoles without power supplies. You know, they'll be buying them from car boot sales or whatever. So this is kind of a good way to get one to fit everything.
Yeah, and you can kind of go to supermarkets and get those, you know, step-down adapters and stuff like that, but it's always better to have something that's properly made and you know it's going to, like, you know, measure the right voltage.
You don't put the wrong polarity in or something and it just goes mad.
Yeah, not what you want to do with, like, a Mega CD or something like Model 1.
Yeah.
So, but it's nice to have these kind of solutions. I know there is, like the Commodore 64 has infamously got an awful power supply. You know, have you ever seen those, the ones that Commodore made?
No, I never saw those.
Well, they're like...
I've only seen the cool Commodore 64 remakes, not the original bread bin ones.
Well, they had, the cheapest power supplies, and they're actually in like epoxy inside, so you can't even, like, service them or anything. They're in, like, a block, like, inside you open them up.
Just moulded.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
To cool them down, apparently, stop them overheating. They were that badly made. But often, you know, with age, they kind of output the wrong power, and most Commodore 64s that are broken now is because the power supply is, like, spazzed out and, like, spat all the mains voltage straight into the RAM chips and everything.
Wow.
So there have been a few companies now that are actually making third-party, you know, Commodore 64 power supplies and stuff too.
Nice.
So, I mean, really, you know, you've got these old hardware, these classics, like, you know, the Sega and the Commodore stuff, but, you know, relying on 30-year-old power supplies for them, especially ones that were made cheap and only meant to last, like, a year or something... Yeah. Not a good idea. So obviously there is a demand for this retro trio.
Useful stuff.
Absolutely. So we'll pop a link in the show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, we did mention Christmas games. Christmas games are actually not all that common anymore.
No, you always used to have like a Christmas edition of something, but you don't seem to get them now. I guess it was kind of a way of stretching the budget, you know, to get more out of the game.
And I also think, I mean, I guess from a commercial perspective, having a game that's only going to sell for like 4 weeks of the year,
yeah.
Probably not the wisest move to make, is it?
Yeah, that's it. But it's probably really easy to do. You just stick a little skin of snow on and then send it out. You know,
well, I thought, you know, it might be quite interesting to kind of cover a few games that we, you know, makes us feel festive when we sit down and play Christmas time. So, any suggestions?
Even though it's not a Christmas game, I used to play Worms DC on the Amiga Director's Cut because you can import maps and stuff. And there was always a lot of snowy kind of maps that you could do on there. And that was always nice. And Toy Commander. Did you ever play that on the Dreamcast? It's kind of like you're in a house and you're in toys and you can fly toy planes or tanks or stuff like that.
Oh, I've seen a video of that actually.
Yeah, everything's giant and it kind of seems really Christmassy just playing as toys, you know?
Well, for me, it's always James Pond Robocod.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of... It's snowing in the intro, isn't it? So it's always Christmassy, that one.
And you go and collect presents and stuff. I think, that game, it's been a long time since I completed it, but I think kind of the story is that you're helping Santa get his toys.
Ah,
I think, okay. So there is like a Christmas element to that game. It just reminds me of being a kid, you know, sitting there with my A500 at Christmas time and the tree being up and playing that game. Similarly, there was a little-known game. I noticed LGR actually did a video on this. It was given away. Do you remember The One magazine, a gaming mag?
Yeah.
In the 90s? I think this was just a cover disc for them. The best bit about this game was actually the theme music, which I couldn't find on YouTube in its entirety, but there is a YouTuber called The Shadows Knows.
Oh, yeah, The Shadows Knows. I know him, yeah.
That's him. This is a Bullfrog demo. So I imagine, like, Peter Molyneux must have, you know, his company back then.
Okay.
And... he's actually got a Let's Play of this with the intro music in, so I'm going to play a bit here. So if Shadows Knows talks over it, that's where the voices come from.
Yeah, we've met Shadows Knows before in Amsterdam as well.
Great bloke, yeah. Isn't he? So, there's your little credit in case we get a copyright strike. But listen to this music. The game's called Psycho Santa. my brother used to put the disc on just to hear the music.
That sounds epic. Because I know there was a competition where they had games like make Christmas-themed Amiga games.
Okay.
Quite a while ago. And I know there was, I think it might not have been Psycho Santa, it might have been like Santa's Rampage or something. But there was one.
That does ring a bell, actually.
Yeah, there was one where Santa went mental.
But, that, I think it was just to cover this at Bullfrog made, you know, it's not the best game.
Yeah.
But again, it's just very festive playing it. And also, you know, I remember, like, you know, Christmas Lemmings, Holiday Lemmings.
Oh, yeah, Holiday Lemmings as well. Yeah, there was, oh, God, so many Lemmings games, isn't there?
And I always remember, you remember Cannon Soccer?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Cannon Soccer, the Game Boy and Amiga format, that was like a cover disc on the Christmas edition that they made. And, like, you know, it's a combination of Sensible Soccer and Cannon Fodder. And that was really good. And also Fire and Ice, and obviously, yeah, you know, we talked about that recently definitely on the show. Christmas version of that, wasn't there, where Cool Coyote's got his little Christmas hat on? So if you've got any good suggestions of Christmas games, we'd love to get a few of those on Facebook and Twitter. You can tweet us at RetroHourUK. One on the Super Nintendo as well, called Days Before Christmas.
Okay.
Where Santa, basically people come to steal all his presents, and he's pissed off, and he's got to go around and get all his presents back. So some random Christmas titles come out. So
totally.
We'd love to get a few of your suggestions.
Good to have stuff to play this year. So
yeah, some new Christmas games, yeah, always appreciated. Now, this is quite an interesting story that you found. Hackers have hit the San Francisco transport system.
Insane. I've never seen anything. Well, actually, a few years ago, there was a guy who managed to find a cable, or somewhat, nobody still knows what happened, but mm-hmm, he managed to find one of the cables that controlled the whole internet for a state in America, and he basically cut it, and then the whole state went off. Now, this is absolutely insane. This is ransomware, but on a mass transit scale. So if you know what ransomware is, it's basically hackers saying, we've taken control of your computer. If you want control back, here's a code.
Yeah, you got to pay some money.
You got to pay some money. But they did this with the whole of San Francisco's transit system. So, displayed across all the messages on computer screens was, you hacked, all data encrypted, contact key, and it had an email address.
Was this on like the big, you know, displays where the timetables are,
yep,
and all that as well?
Yep.
Wow.
And they had to cut off all the train machines, card machines, because all the staff got really scared of what was going to happen to people putting their credit cards in,
yeah,
and stuff
God
like that. So, you know, this whole thing shut down the train system. It's insane.
And then, yeah, I'm looking at the story here. He demanded $75,000 in bitcoins.
Yeah. So it would be untraceable to him as well.
You know, first of all, you've got to kind of think, how does that happen? How is there such a big security flaw in your system? You know, especially something on that scale that's running like trains. I mean, potentially could have done a lot of damage, you know, imagine the signal boxes and all that, you could make a crash.
You know, it's scary, this, like the panic that could happen with that as well, because you even think the staff, like, would just be like, what the hell? But if you're a user of the public system and it's just like, you've been hacked, you know.
And everything's computerized now, isn't it? It's
totally.
It's so, obviously, someone, you know, someone should be sacked for their computer, like security guys, shouldn't they? You know, maybe not be
definitely,
in the job next year,
but I just find it intriguing as well that they're using ransomware. That, you know, he's saying he's not just doing it for the lols, he's doing it for Bitcoin, which is really bad.
Well, ransomware is kind of like, you know, it's probably the malware that frightens me the most. I mean, I keep backups of everything.
Mm.
But I also think, like, you know, there are certain cases where, you know, there have been cases like this in the past where agencies, you know, government agencies and companies have had to pay up. Because a lot of these things have been built.
Sony's had to pay up for some of the stuff. They've actually got ransomware themselves quite a lot of time. And there's a whole argument, do we pay these hackers?
Yeah.
Because then we're enabling them and, you know,
encouraging more, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but then, I mean, a lot of them use like 128K encryption. You're never going to crack it. You know what I mean? So either you want your stuff back or you
pay
it.
Yeah, it's like CIA level encryption. So it's really interesting. And, you know, is this going to become a thing where hackers, you know, doing ransomware, doing it for random companies, you know, attacking infrastructure. It's
people
scary.
Got to up the game, haven't they? It's
definitely.
Like, well, even like, you know, I remember, you know, I was actually reading the other day, remember the very first computer worm, the Morris worm, have you heard about that?
Yeah, yeah.
In November 1988. And there is actually the Computer History Museum. You can go and see the floppy disk. It's got the source code of it on there.
Oh.
But I was watching the news report on YouTube all about, you know, how that attacked. And obviously then no one ever thought that kind of happened. It took everyone by surprise, but really, I kind of change everything, but it makes you realise even like 30 years
but
on, really.
Also, even stuff like that was kind of had the intent of being non-malicious.
That was more mischievous, wasn't it?
Mischievous, yeah. Well, this is a direct kind of malicious extraction of money, extortion, yeah.
Well, they even reckon, you know, when that Morris worm hit, apparently that cost, the US government reckoned that, you know, that cost $10 million, you know, that infection that got, that was in 1988.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's a big business, isn't it? Yeah,
definitely.
You
know,
a bit
definitely
shady. Right then, so Win UAE, that's a great emulator.
Oh, yeah, the what did they used to call it? Useless Amiga emulator. Now it's very useful.
Yeah, then it was Unix Amiga emulator. Now it's universal, I think, isn't it? So if you're not familiar with this, I'm sure everyone who's listening to this is. This is the Windows version of UAE, which is the most advanced version. And Tony and the guys who make this, Tony Willen, they put so much in here as well. And they're always on EAB, the English Amiga board. And what's cool about it is this project, users can just submit requests to them and you go, oh, I'll put it in. Like, he put, like, you know, PowerPC code in there, like,
yeah,
last year.
Yeah, that was mad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he just puts it in. Now, this is even madder, actually. He's now put American Laserdisc game support in there.
What? I didn't... Was there even Laserdisc stuff for the Amiga, had it?
Well, I was reading the forum. This kind of surprised me. Do you remember Mad Dog McCree?
Yeah, this shooting Laserdisc one.
Yeah, cowboy game. That ran an Amiga 500.
What?
Yeah.
So was the actual arcade unit, and it just connected with the Laserdisc. That's amazing. Wow.
There's quite a lot of Amiga Laserdisc games. It was there. Mad Dog 2, The Lost Gold, Gallagher's Gallery, Space Pirates, and Who Shot Johnny Rock, with the titles on it. So
do you think that there's probably going to be ISOs of these out, or there's going to be some kind of CD image?
Well, looking at EAB at the moment, I mean, they've got the interface to work. They had to kind of emulate this, you know, interface between the Amiga and the Laserdisc player. They've got that working, and they've actually, I think they're trying to find the files, but they've actually found the DOS version has got these files in that they need, and someone's now got it booting Mad Dog McCree, apparently, on this code.
Yes.
So
that's excellent.
I mean, because Mad Dog McCree, I've got it on the 3DO. I do remember playing it in the arcade, and, it, you know, first time I'd really seen a video game that was like a movie.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd seen it on Games Master, and I was just like, wow, what's
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I've seen that episode recently, actually. Yeah. So I didn't know it ran on, like, it's an Amiga 500 with a Laserdisc player and, like, a Genlock, you know, to overlay the graphics and stuff. So.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that could work very easily, actually, because I know they had a lot of small-powered systems and then a fat Laserdisc comes off of it, you know, to do the brunt of the work.
Oh, Dragon's Lair was a Laserdisc game, wasn't it, in the early 80s?
Yeah, yeah.
So I've never had a Laserdisc player, though. I quite fancy one now.
They're really nice aesthetically. When was the first time you saw a Laserdisc?
Probably about, I remember in the early 90s, there was actually a shop I used to go to called Chips, like a video game shop, on like a weekend. And they, for a couple of years, they had like a few arcades and, like, you know, you go in there, get like Amiga and Mega Drive and stuff games. Out the back, they had like a movie memorabilia bit. Ah. And you went in there and they had like a big popcorn machine in there and there was like loads of Laserdiscs. I remember my friend Ricky at school, like his dad, he was like a guy, he bought any new gadget that came out, he had like a CDI and CD TV,
hot,
all that kind of stuff.
Hot tech guy.
Always, you know, single dad he was, you know, with his son. He had a bit of money and that. So he'd just buy loads of new stuff. And I remember he got a Laserdisc player. And I went around my friend Ricky's and, like, he had, like, Ghostbusters 2 and, like, Batman and stuff on Laserdisc.
Wow.
And he had to, like, he'd watch, like, you know, 45 minutes of the film, have to get up and turn it round, like, the disc to watch it. But
yeah, I remember going into an old hi-fi store in my local area and then just having all these beautiful hi-fis. But then suddenly I was like, what's this? And it was, like, a big video vinyl player. And actually, the early model, you could hear it as
spinning.
It was going round.
Okay,
yeah, yeah. I don't know if it was the early versions or something, but it seemed really cheap.
Probably to make, not to buy, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was like, I just think they look really cool as well, though, because a lot of movies had great artwork, but even, like, you know, on a VHS, it was small, and even, like, when DVDs were even smaller.
Yeah.
But Laserdisc, it's like, it's basically a CD.
Vinyl size, isn't it? 12-inch, yeah.
It looks like a big CD, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I've always thought they're really cool, but obviously when I was a kid, they're way out of my price range.
I've got another thing for us to start collecting, Dan. God.
I've seen there are guys on YouTube that collect them, aren't they? And they've got some really impressive collections. Techmoan, does he have...
Oh, yeah, he's got every obscure, weird format that's ever come out.
Yeah, there might be something to look into next year. I've got no idea what the prices are of them these days, but I imagine they're already going up, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure you'll be able to find one in a charity shop somewhere.
You know, you say that. I never find anything good in charity shops. Most of them can't even take electronics, I don't think, these days, can they?
Oh, mate, you're going to the wrong place. I found some great stuff, Doom Collector's Edition, all sealed and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, my boss at work today, he was telling me, he said, oh, a friend of mine has got a Super Nintendo from, like, a charity shop. And he was like, oh, I think he paid over the odds for it. He paid like £25. And I was like, dude, that's like, they go for like three times that, on eBay. So
I'll give you some charity shop tips later.
But yeah, I think, you know, maybe I'm going the wrong ones. I did find a Dreamcast keyboard in one once.
Oh, that's cool.
For like a pound.
Yeah.
I don't know, but the only thing I've ever found, apart from that, copies of like FIFA on the PS2.
Go to the ones that are full of old ladies. Those are the best because there's no young people around to get the electronics. So you have like the pick.
Neo Geo, you can have that 50p.
Yeah, that's it.
So if you found any good bargains in charity shops, that'd be quite interesting to find out, you know, what you've picked up. Because I do hear stories. And I always think, oh, why does that never happen to me? Why do I find anything like that? Now, this is a pretty sad day, you could say. 30 years... the Commodore 64 held the crown as the biggest selling personal computer of all time.
But it's about to be overtaken by the Raspberry Pi.
That's no surprise. If anyone was going to do it, it's going to be the Pi, isn't it?
Yeah, I got three of them sitting in my drawer.
I mean, you probably count for half of this sales.
Yeah, that's it.
It's about to hit 11 million then.
Yeah, massive amount. And the guy, the head of Pi, Dr. Eben Upton, has received a CBE. And also, he's said some really good stuff here. And it's one of the main things that was probably the biggest surprise for them was that they were able to build them in the UK as cheaply as they would in China.
Oh, so they're all built here, are they?
Yeah, they're all built.
Cool. Okay, interesting. But that's awesome. I mean, 11 million is, you know, it's a big number. And the Commodore 64, I think, you know, there are estimates that it sold anywhere between 12.5 million and 17 million. So I don't think there's any, like, real concrete figures, but if it's at the lower end, I mean, the Pi will probably overtake that, you know. I imagine we'll probably do another Raspberry Pi in the next few months.
Oh, definitely, because there's this other one, the Orange Pi, that's a kind of more souped-up version. So they're probably going to try and soup themselves up a bit more and get a bit more power out of the machine.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the saying here, it would be a nice thing if we can do a couple of million. It would be sad if 11 million is where we stop, but they must have more plans. But if we get past the Commodore 64, it's then in third place after the PC and the Mac.
Did you ever think it would be this successful when you first heard of it?
I always thought it would be, because I wanted one as soon as I read about the Raspberry Pi. Yeah. You know, I thought, yeah, for hobbyists and hackers and that, it might be a cool little gadgety kind of device.
Yeah, but mainstream.
Yeah, I didn't think it, you know, obviously a big use of the Pi has been in education and training kids and all, which I think is cool. But yeah, I didn't kind of think it would go into that market.
But also Linux TV boxes.
Yeah.
Everybody I know from young to old ladies have a Raspberry Pi and they're doing
coding on
it. Yeah, it's crazy.
But it's costing so cheap. I mean, just like you said, you've got like three. I've got three of them as well at home. I've got like, you know, my Raspberry Pi Model 1's in a drawer. I don't really use it anymore. I might stick an FTP server on it or something, but it's like the disposable computers really, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. Like I was thinking the other day, oh, what should I do? Should I create like a little Tor router with it or should I create a radio thing with it? And there's so many little discoveries and projects you can do with it. It's great. It's brought that whole hacking and playing with computers back.
You're right there. I mean, you think like, you know, back in the 2000s, for example, computers really became a commodity, didn't they? An appliance.
Yeah, something that's in a metal case that you don't get into.
Yeah, an Excel box or a web browser.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The Pi, I think, you know, it's kind of going back to that like late 70s, early 80s, you know, a machine that you buy to mess around with the computer and see what you can do with it.
And do crazy projects.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are. I mean, you know, even on the Raspberry Pi's website, you go on there, the Pi Foundation site, there are uses on there, and there's so many different things, everything from, obviously, weather stations, everyone makes a weather station with a Pi.
But even, you know, big companies taking notice, like Amazon, and releasing the Amazon Echo software for the Pi as well.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
Windows on it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Microsoft released Windows 10 on it, like Arm Edition. It's like, and, you know, well, they're saying here, you know, that 11 million would be a sad place to stop, and obviously the Pi's recently had a bit of an annual schedule, hasn't it? So it's usually in March and your model comes out. So they must be working on the Raspberry Pi 4 for early next year.
Oh, God, I'm going to have like every year worth of Pi until the Raspberry Pi 30.
But again, it's like, yeah, it's only like 25, 30 quid. I'll get one. Actually, I've spent about $2,000 on Pis in the last decade. You know what I mean? So obviously, if the Pi 4 does come out next year, they're actually my most popular videos on YouTube, you know.
Really?
Yeah, my Raspberry Pi videos, so I'll be there on day one.
Yeah, that's it. Upload it.
Right, thank you so much for checking out episode number 48 of the Retro Hour podcast. We'll be out again next Friday, available from your favourite podcast clients. And now, for the next 45 minutes or so, this week's interview is so good. Let's get the history of core design, games like Bubba and Sticks.
And we've got Simon Phipps.
And we'll catch you next Friday.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it's time to welcome this week's special guest, Simon Phipps. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, you're welcome, Dan and Ravi. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we're going to get into you know, some of the highlights of your career in just a moment, but we thought it would be really good to go all the way back to the start. Where did it all begin then? What was your first experience with a computer?
First experience with a computer was 1981. I was at school, 81, I would have been 15, and my mate Philip Basker told me that he'd got a computer, and him and his dad had been making a ZX81 out of a kit from an electronics magazine. This is when you kind of just bought all the bare bits and pieces and assembled the thing. And so I went round to his house sort of age 15 after school, and it was like, let's have a look at this thing. And there it was, this little tiny piece of plastic plugged into a black and white TV. The screen hit static every time the display updated, and you were able to type stuff in it and make it happen on screen. Now, for me, I'd always wanted to make movies and stuff like that. I'd always been fascinated with animation since I was really, really tiny. Parents never had the money to afford a cine camera or 8mm or anything like this. So when I saw this, this was like a way of getting something onto your TV and that you could make do stuff. And I remember him showing me a 1K Space Invaders. The 1K Space Invaders was literally, it was, I think it was a H moving across the screen, some A's moving down the screen. And as I say, every time the screen updated, there was a burst of static and then it moved. And I remember saying to him, you know, so can I change what those things look like? You know, because I've got that sort of thing in my head, sort of thinking, well, you know, I've seen Space Invaders in the arcade. Maybe you could change the graphics. It was like, yeah, you could change those A's into maybe B's or C's or whatever. And I was like, and so that's where it came for me, was this opportunity to take artwork and put it on screen and actually make it move and be able to manipulate it. So I got fascinated with that, started playing around with the Commodore PETs that we had at school. And then I was looking at computers. And at the time, there was the Acorn Atom that Acorn computers had coming out. And that was really cool because it had color and stuff. And then on the horizon, there was Acorn producing the BBC Micro. And so it was one of those sort of things I was like, right, well, you know, I'd like one of these Acorn Atoms because the BBC Micro is really expensive. Mm-hmm. And my parents turned around and went, look, you know, you really want a computer, we'll put, I think it was £100 towards what you've saved up from your paper rounds and stuff. And you'll be able to get a BBC Model A. So May 16th, 1982, which was my 16th birthday, my cousin went to a local store that's only a couple of miles down the road and picked up one of their first five BBC microcomputers.
BBCs were very expensive as well, though, then. You must have done quite a lot of paper rounds.
Yeah, I think it was £299, I think it was. And I'd been sort of saving paper round money for years and stuff. And my parents actually put towards it as well, kind of thing. And it was, you know, I mean, when you actually calculate it, it's like the equivalent of buying a really high-end PC, you know, sort of thing. And we didn't have that much money to fling around. So it was a really big deal. And so I'd always sort of set my sights on the Acorn Atom. My parents were like, we'll put some money towards it as well. I got this box of wonder, you know, sort of thing. And all of a sudden it was like, right, what can I do with this? And so you played Planetoid and Snapper, which were arcade perfect clones of Defender and
Pac-Man, wasn't it? Yeah.
And then it was like straight into the basics. So then what I then did was spent a lot of time teaching myself how to program in BASIC, draw circles and stuff. And this was the wonderful thing about it, was having grown up in a world where, you know, art was felt tip pens, taking the back ends off them and scrubbing them all over the paper to try and get a decent sort of color fill or whatever, like that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. There I was able to paint with light, and all the colors were like super saturated and bright and wonderful. And it was like, this is, you know, magic in a box. At that time, I think I'd seen Jetpack on the Spectrum.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I fancy making a little man that with a jetpack on. And so I wrote this game. And at the time I was doing this, so this would be in 1983, I was friends with a chap named Stu Gregg. He came round to my house, and I think it was probably because I was the kid with a computer, and we got on and stuff like that. So we'd have evenings where we'd be playing things like Chucky Egg on the BBC Micro and stuff like that. And I was writing this little game with the jetpack on. One day, he said, you know what, you should send that to a publisher, see if somebody could do it. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, do it. Yeah, I'm sure you could do. So I was like, oh,
Had you been reading about, like, the, you know, the other kids at the time that were, like, sending games in and all of a sudden, like, getting full-time jobs? And, you know, there was all that kind of, like, you know, Bedrooms to Millions kind of stuff going on back then, wasn't there?
Yeah, you know, sort of thing. And I was like, well, okay then. So I bunged it on a tape and I sent it off to A&F Software and Micropower over in Leeds. And A&F Software came back and said, with a very official sort of letter saying, oh, I'm sorry, we can't do this. We only accept games that are 100% machine code because of our protection scheme and piracy and all this lot. I was like, fine, okay, whatever. And Micropower came back and we were like, oh, we love this. Here's a list of 10 changes. If you can make these, we'd be really interested. And so they took it on and came up with the name Jet Power Jack for it. So there I was. In the middle of my A-levels, at sort of 17, 18, and I got a game out on the BBC Micro on tape.
Did you think it would be a career at that point when you initially made the game?
No, it was just a thing that I did. And interestingly, at the time I was doing my A-levels, which were maths, physics and chemistry. And what I found was my pure maths teacher was also the computer teacher. So half of my pure maths lesson was, Simon, could you just come in the back here and just show me how to, set up a printer on the BBC Micro? I'm having problems with doing this, that and the other. So gradually, my maths education nosedived and I spent more of my time talking and spent it, you know, in the computer room helping my maths teacher get prepped. So I got to the end of my A-levels and completely messed them all up. My plan was to go off and do computer science at a big university. And I got some really lousy grades, but I'd had a great time doing all this computer stuff and things like that kind of thing. And if there's one thing that I've, now having kids, I've turned around and said to the pair of them, you know, take the subjects that you really love because that's what's going to get you furthest, not what you think you should be doing.
How supportive were your parents at the time then? Were they very supportive of your decision?
They just wanted me to have a really great education. So I think the thing is that I was, they never really understood computers. It was a thing that I did up in my bedroom and they were just sort of like, whatever you do, get your education. And of course, in my brain at that point, I'm thinking, well, I can do maths and physics and chemistry, and that's what you should do. You should get a solid education. So anyway, I got to the end of my A-levels, and my one backstop was the Polytechnic in Nottingham, Trent Poly, which accepted me. And in fact, weirdly enough, I'd done all of the rounds of all of the universities and been to Trent Poly, and the people at Trent Poly were lovely. So I had a wonderful time, and all of the lecturers were all ex-industry. So they were going, you know, this is what a computer does out in ICI. This is what a computer... So I had this wonderful sort of like documentary on all these amazing things that were really fascinating that I just sort of sunk myself into. I had a middle year in my course, which required me to go out into industry. And one of my lecturers came to me and went, look, your programming stuff is up there. And it's like, well, yeah. I kind of have already published a game and stuff like this kind of thing. We've got an opening at IBM. I was like, okay. Oh, wow. Yeah, so IBM in Nottingham. I was like, oh, that's cool. This is local. It's in the marketing department. What do you think? And I was like, well, you know, IBM that at that time was like somebody going, you're going to go work for Microsoft or Apple. And had an absolute blast. It was completely different. It was working in a big professional office with, you know, stripping down PCs, putting them back together, organizing events. I got the opportunity to use my art skills on newsletters and bits and pieces, and it was a complete break for me. And at the end of the year, they said, oh, you know, if you want to come back, we'd be only too happy to have you when you finished your course. And I was like, me work for a giant American multinational corporation? Nah, probably not, but thanks very much. Went back. I was working in my spare time at a computer shop in Derby, a computer shop called First Byte.
Yeah.
And there I got to know all of the local, all the guys that that hung out on a Saturday and talked tapes and stuff like this. So I finished my Trent Poly course and I was like, what do I do? And then I got a call from a friend of mine, Terry Lloyd. Now, Terry I'd known for years. He was one of the regular guys that used to pop into First Byte computers in Derby and was like one of the guys that you'd just always see around the shop at First Bite. He'd first turned up as a customer, then ended up working in the store and everything. And eventually he and a group of guys that used to frequent the store, himself, Rob Toon, Andy Green, and Chris Shrigley, had all got together and written a game called Bounder for, Chris, Rob and Andy had written a game called Bounder for the Commodore 64. Mm-hmm. They actually in a monitor because they actually didn't have an assembler. So they literally sat there and hand-coded an entire game and its graphics by turning it into numbers and poking it into the memory.
And on a Commodore 64, that was hardcore because the BASIC was terrible on the C64.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And say they didn't even have an assembler.
Yeah.
So it was literally just going into memory and just going like that. So, you know, absolute respect to them because it's just insane. Even back then, it was insane.
Yeah.
Terry had got gone and joined them and started doing graphics for things like Future Night and Crackout and all this kind of stuff. And I got a phone call from Terry going, Sam, you still kind of drawing art and stuff like that. We just need somebody to do some freelance graphics for us. I was like, yeah, okay then. So I quickly put together a disc with a load of stuff that I'd drawn on my Atari ST because I'd kind of gone on from BBC Micro to Amstrad CPC because that had a nice assembly cartridge called Maxam, which allowed you to write Z80 in line with BASIC like you could on the Beeb.
It's quite interesting that you swerved the Commodore 64 then. Did you not find that an enjoyable machine to work on?
The thing was, it was quite impenetrable. For me, it's always been about the tool that allowed me to make something rather than been the entertainment system. So out of all of the stuff that was there, for me, the Amstrad was the thing. Once I saw it had got Maxam, the Commodore was this, you know, I mean, having sold the things in and spent days, weeks of my life with non-turbo loading tapes at the store and its wishy-washy graphics, I really wasn't a fan. You know, I mean, I knew it sold a load and I spent many a happy hour at Terry's house playing a Commodore 64 on a Sunday afternoon where it's like, okay, then we'll play two players, Spy versus Spy and all this kind of stuff and all the latest things. But as something to own, it didn't offer me anything to create anything. Whereas yeah. When the Amstrad came along, it was like, oh, right, I know what I've been doing with the BBC. This is like a Z80-based BBC Micro, and I can now learn Z80 and stuff. So I dabbled with a load of stuff like that kind of thing. And this has always been a thread of mine, is I enjoy games, but I enjoy making games and making things much, much more than I do playing them. I'm hideously bad at technical manuals, those big things full of guides to registers that the genius guys that I work with and have over the years can pick up and go, oh yes, if you interrupt the so-and-so and this, that and the other event, forget it. But once I've got into the machine, the logic side and everything like that, I can get my head around.
Well, before we move on from First Bite, I thought it might be quite interesting just to kind of get a picture of what went on in like a mid-80s computer store then. Were you more dealing to like, was it the public or was it more like corporate work you were doing?
Oh, no, it was straight to the public. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, all the things that you remember of an 80s computer shop, Dragon 32, BBC Micros, Commodore 64s, Amstrads, and kids coming in on a Saturday going, 10, print, poo, 20, go to 10, and then running out of the store.
I was probably one of those kids.
Yeah, the big thing about that was lots of sort of like parents coming in with kids where they were buying a computer for education, but you could see in the kids' eyes, it was like, I want to blow up spaceships. Or situations where you'd have someone coming in and sort of wanting to buy something that was sort of inappropriate. And I do remember spending a lot of time kind of going, no, you don't want this. You're better off with one of these things because that suits what you do. And then you'd kind of wait a few weeks and bless them, they'd come back and actually had taken your advice, and then you'd see them forever after that. So I do remember there were a few bits and pieces.
It's got better graphics to help with your homework.
Yeah, you know, sort of thing. It was all of that sort of stuff. Big racks of cassette tapes with a little lock and key that you could kind of pull out. And actually, one of my fond memories was in those very early days, my friend Terry coming in as a customer at that time, when the next big game drop, whether Jet Set Willy or whatever, it's going, is it in yet? Is it in yet? You know, sort of thing. And that kind of excitement for the release of the next thing, you know, sort of thing and stuff. So, yeah, it was all of the stuff that you remember. I got a little bit of staff discount on the title. So BBC titles were a little bit more affordable. And also the other one as well is you know, kind of, I got exposed to games on the Spectrum and the Commodore 64 that otherwise I owning one computer I wouldn't have. So, you know, you kind of got to see them. Several things that little sort of like memories that do exist. 45 minutes trying to slow load a copy of China Miner.
Well, that sounds fun.
You know, at this tape, it won't load. And you know that people have bought stuff, probably fiddle around with the tape or kind of thing, and brought it back and were trying to psych you out because of the fact that it would take so long to load in the days before turbo loaders. So you're like, okay then, right, well, let's test it. And you put it in, you know, clean the tape heads and all this kind of thing, and then send them back out the door with the tape that we're going to try and get a refund on. All those kind of turbo loaders. The summer of 1984, listening to nothing but the Commodore 64 Ghostbusters title theme on a loop.
Ghostbusters!
6 days a week for 6 whole weeks. That was bonkers.
Does it still make you feel sick hearing that now?
Oh, probably. I had been a long time. A slightly earlier memory was buying my Micro Vitek RGB monitor for my BBC Micro and having to lug it by hand by myself all the way across Derby to get it back to my car.
They weren't like those LCRTs, were they?
Make sure you don't drop
monstrous.
It.
Monstrous. You know, it was heavy anyway, and then in a big box. So, yeah, that was a thing.
Well, moving on from First Byte then, this is obviously when like the Gremlin graphics kind of era of your career started. So how did the job start there then? What was the stage of that?
So, yeah, there I was. Terry phoned me up and said, hey, you know, we'd like you to, are you interested in doing some freelance graphics? So I was like, go on then. So put together a disc, drove through to Terry's house on this awful, the snowiest night I remember. The car was sliding all over the place, to deliver him this disc, and got back home. And then the following day, it was like, we've shown it to the guys. Would you like to come in and have a chat? I was like, okay then. So I've got him a car, I think the subsequent day and subsequent evening. And arrived in Derby at about 6 o'clock to Saxon House at the back of just off Friargate, and there in this little tiny office with all the sort of foam core tiles in the ceiling, the grey carpeting, and big long. It was actually two offices that were sort of knocked through into one. I met Greg Holmes, Dave Pridmore, Kevin Norburn, my mate Terry, Rob and Andy, and Chris, who I'd known from the shop, and started chatting to them and said, oh, yeah, this is what I can do and things like that, thinking I was going to get like a little freelance spare time gig or whatever like that. And I just went away. They were all really, really nice. And then I got phoned up the following day going, would you like a full-time job? I was like, really? What? In games? Like, yeah, as a graphic artist. I was like, okay.
Wow.
Working on Masters of the Universe, the movie, the live game for the Atari. So I can remember sitting around my mum's kitchen table with Jane, who is my wife. She was going, right, okay, what do we think? I'm going to have to take a drop in salary. It's for a games company. Don't know how long it's going to last. Should we give it a go? And Jane was like, well, look, as much as you're enjoying this, you know, sitting in your little nerd cube writing stuff about pointers and sort algorithms and all this lot, I can see you're bored. Give it a go. We'll see how long it lasts. You know, this is where I am now. After all these years, we've still been giving it a go. And it's a career that has seen me meet amazing people, work in all sorts of different places. I've been able to play with amazing toys and licenses, go around the world, literally. And we're still giving it a go. And it's been one hell of a roller coaster ride. So that's kind of it. So I went and joined Gremlin Graphics in their little Derby office, working as a graphic artist.
What was a typical day like at Gremlin?
It was, you know, get on the bus, heading to Derby, down the corridor, make a big trayful of cups of tea, and the sort of seven or eight of us sit there and make games as quickly as possible. For the early part, I think myself and Terry spent our time, the office with this big long kind of almost like a corridor, really, with made out of standard, you know, kind of office ceiling tiles, floor tiles, and walls. And as I recall, it was sort of partitioned off a little bit at one end. There was like a small kind of what might have been a storeroom or whatever, like that kind of thing at one end, and then the main room. So in the main room, all the programming guys sat, and me and Terry sat in this little tiny sort of 12-foot square, sort of what would have been a storeroom with a window, back to back, both on Atari STs, clicking away at pixels. I was using OCP Art Studio on the Atari, because that was the one package that was really dedicated to sprite graphics and animation. Yeah. on the Atari. It was really, really easy. And what I then found that I ended up doing was I got from the programming guys the specs for their various different, you know, sprites and character things. So what I ended up doing was starting to write my own tools so I could draw the art, arrange it how I wanted it, and then rip the sprites in various different forms and just pass it by disk to the guys, so that then there wasn't any of this horrible sort of faffing around with, right, now you've drawn the things, get them onto the host machine and then take them apart and all this kind of stuff. So that's kind of we did it. And the one thing that I do have a memory of Gremlin in those days, of me and Terry would be sort of like, particularly after lunch, sitting there back to back clicking away. And it would just be silence, and you'd hear just a little bit of a patter of keys. And at one point or other, one of the two of us would just go, mouse clicks, because the silence apart from that was deafening. And we just sort of lost ourselves in this little world of pixels, Wolf Lundgren's 64 pixel high musculature and stuff like that. So, it was, and at that point, we were sort of knocking off at 5:30 and stuff like that, and maybe had a couple of late nights whilst making the game, but just at the end of it. But generally, it was, you know, like a 9-to-5 job where you're getting paid and you're making games.
Well, you mentioned Masters of the Universe was the first project that you were working on there. I mean, obviously, I remember the movie came out, didn't it? And that was a really, really big film. I mean, how did they get the license for that then, being like a new company?
I don't know. I just arrived and they were going, we're making this Masters of the Universe film. It's based on, you know, the Dolph Lundgren film. They had a stack of photos, probably about 250 4x6 photographs like this, of just sort of publicity shots and shots from the set and stuff like that kind of thing. They'd seen a rough cut of the movie and they were well into production making this game. So I just sort of turned up like, what do you want me to draw? Eight directions of He-Man walking down a street from a helicopter view. We need a view of, you know, this sort of like, because it was the game that they were made was... There was a sort of a top-down section, which then led to loads of little mini-games, little fighting mini-game, little Operation Wolfstar mini-game. So I ended up sort of picking up bits and pieces here and there. And whatever. What does Skeletor look like? Oh, it looks like this. And so I was sort of drawing those bits and pieces whilst they were making the game. So it really was a sort of hit the ground running. We're in the middle of something, just support us. The one thing about kind of like where we were technology wise at that point was we needed a title screen. Of course, you're drawing all of your art with mouse at that point. Mm-hmm. No digitizing hardware available, no scanners, no nothing. And so it was like, how do I draw this complicated, you know, kind of gorgeous, I think it was a Drew Struzan movie poster, actually, thinking about it.
Right.
You know, the guy that did Indiana Jones, I think it was one of his, you know, sort of paintings for the movie poster. How do I get that on an Atari screen? So I kind of sat there with a mouse trying to copy it, and I kind of gridded it up with just sort of a grid and Oh, it was failing horribly. And I was like, you know what? If I make the grid small enough, I can probably do this. So I got a huge piece of tracing paper and drew something like, you know, a 2 millimeter grid on the tracing paper, stuck it down onto this big poster, and then for 2 days went pixel by pixel by pixel, grid by grid by grid, just clicking an approximate color, you know, hand scanning, hand digitizing effectively this poster, got it within, you know, sort of 75%, scaled it out a little bit because my grid had been off and everything was a bit tall and thin, and then filled in the rest.
That is nuts.
But it was, you know, it was bonkers, but it got me the result that I wanted, you know, and it was the easiest way to do it. It was like I could spend 2 days cursing, you know, not being able to make my hand move or whatever. I could just sit here, switch my brain off and click, 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 click.
Well, obviously, after Gremlin, your next big move was to the now legendary Core Design. How did you make that move then? Where did that story start?
So what happened was I'd been working at Gremlin for a few months, and Gremlin hit a cash crisis, and they had to start making some cuts. And one of the cuts was cutting the Derby office. And they sort of offered us all redundancy, or we could go and work up in Sheffield. And of course, like having an 80-mile round trip every day was like, nah, don't fancy that. We'll take the money and we'll work out what to do. And in those sort of like last days, Jeremy Smith, Kevin Norburn, and Greg Holmes got together, and say Jeremy was the sales manager at Gremlin at that time. Kevin was one of the original founders of Gremlin, and Greg was like our office manager and basically dad at Gremlin. They all pitched together and said, "Look, you know, we'd like to set up a company. Would you guys like to work for us here? Just carry on doing what you're doing." I was like, "Yeah, all right then." So basically, we finished Gremlin, and then a couple of days later, just came back in the office and Core started from there. The other side of it was we were able to pitch original ideas. So I remember sitting there in those very, very early days with Terry in the back room where we were going, right, let's write down on a piece of paper what's been done lately. And we were kind of like, I can distinctly remember Capcom's Black Tiger had just been out in the arcade.
Okay? Yeah.
So we were like, okay, won't do a swords and sorcery thing, won't do a space thing, won't do a this, that, that. You know what's not been done for a long while? Like an Indiana Jones game. Yeah. Those are, you know, the games that have been out were just sort of like quite generic. And the arcade games were okay. But nobody'd ever got that idea of that very first, you know, sort of few minutes of Raiders, where Indy's running hell for leather, you know, being attacked with traps, rolling balls and all this kind of stuff. And so it's like, you know what, we could do kind of a game based around that. So I started to doodle these little characters. I remember, was it Joe Blade had come out on the Spectrum at the time with these little squashed characters, and I thought, oh, that's really cool. Reminded me of a Spanish artist, Mordillo, who used to create all these amazing super detailed posters with all these little characters in back in the 70s. And I thought, oh, you know, we can do that. So I started doodling these little sort of squished characters. And we were like, well, could we do, you know, rolling boulders, spike pits and all this sort of stuff? And I'm like, well, hang on a minute, each one of these things is just a sprite. And generally speaking, these sprites are still at the start. You walk into a box, and when you walk into an invisible box on the screen, they start moving, whether it's rolling to a pattern on the screen or flying off or shooting at you and things like that. And then I was like, well, you know, and those sprites can either be deadly at the start or not, or solid at the start or not and everything. And within that afternoon, I'd kind of come up with a way that we could make all of these sort of Indiana Jones type traps from basically a sprite, a collision box and a bunch of flags. And so I sort of sat there with Terry going, right, OK, then think of another thing. And it was like, OK, crushing ceilings. Oh, right. OK, this is one of these rolling boulders and, you know, spike pits. You get stuck in a thing, spikes hit you, bat comes down, all bits and pieces. And every time Terry would pitch something out, I was like, well, you could set it up like this and you could. So we came up with this idea that became Rip Dangerous. The name I didn't realize up until many years later, I'd probably picked up in the ether. There was the Dangerous Brothers, Rick Mayall and
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's interesting.
Ed Edmondson did back on Friday Night Live.
Yeah.
And Rick and Vivian Dangerous.
Ah,
so for some reason or other, Rick Dangerous must have stayed in my brain, and it kind of came out as the name there, and I was totally unaware of it until many years later. I was like, oh, I, you know, that must have snuck its way in. So we pitched that to Jeremy. He went, yeah, okay, then took it round, and we got, you know, somebody said, yeah, you can go off and make that. So
to me, it's like it's like a Tomb Raider in 2D. You know, you've kind of got these traps, you've got to work stuff out, and it's got lot more
well,
than
no mistake
a standard
that
platformer.
You know, and I mean, somebody many years ago, and I think there's a link off it on my website, went, it had sort of independently looked at it and went, I think Rick Dangerous is probably, you know, kind of Lara's great uncle, and it's no mistake that a tomb raiding related thing came out of Core many years later, because after Rick Dangerous, it felt for a big long time that I was being asked to remake and remake and remake and remake that in some shape or form for many years, because we'd had a success with it, and it was like, hey, you do this, you know, sort of thing, and you're going, yeah, but I want to do more stuff. I've already done one of those. I want to do more stuff. I want to advance. I want to go on. So the thread, the desire to make a, to recapture that Indiana Jones, Rick Dangerous thing would have played into a receptiveness to doing an indie game. But, you know, I mean, credit to Toby for bringing the art that he did do that kind of set the whole thing in motion and stuff like that. But I think I think Rick laid some of the groundwork that, you know, many years later, it's like, yeah, we should do one of those things, because there were circumstances along the way. It was like, could we make another game with a man with a, I want to do 3D. I want to do something that's not a man running along a platform and jumping again. You know?
Well, there was one game that you mentioned, you know, like really unique art there, and one game that you were involved with it called Bubba and Sticks. I thought that had such an original look to that game. Where did the concept of that game come from then?
Well, you see, right, yeah. So we made Rick Dangerous. I'd become a programmer on Rick Dangerous 1, and I did a load of programming from then on, because actually Rick was my first... full-time 100% machine code game, and we ended up doing Rick sequel. I then went on to do Wolfchild, which was another push to try and get more realistically proportioned graphics and all this kind. Come to the end of Wolfchild, and Jeremy had got this idea. It's like, at that time, rotoscope graphics were sort of kicking around.
Yeah, so Flashback and Prince of Persia and all that, wasn't it?
Flashback and stuff like that kind of thing, where you had lots of programmers running up and down car parks with cameras tracing over the screen and stuff like that. And Jeremy came to me and said, I've got this idea. We kind of film all of the graphics, and we have this guy. He's kind of like an Indiana Jones kind of guy. I'm like, and he's got this stick, and he can do all of these things with a stick. And I was just like, I don't want to do one of these anymore. And I've done enough platform games. Everybody's making 3D. There's Thunderhawk. There's all of these things. And I don't want to make another platform game. And I was looking at the prospect of doing these digitized graphics. And I was thinking, I can do them. But they look, personally, I always thought they looked horrible, you know, sort of thing. When they were done well for the time, they worked. But, you know, most often than not, they were a bit nasty. And you could still tell it was a programmer running up and down inside a car park and stuff. And the other aspect of it was, what could you do with a stick? Because, you know, it's a physical object of sort of like a tangible length. So you could have a stick, which, you know, a couple of feet long, you poke it in things and maybe throw it, and then it would fall on the floor and you have to go and pick it up. It could be a staff, so you could fight with it, and you could do things, and maybe you could use it as a bit of a crowbar, and you could poke it in things and stuff. Or, if you wanted to be, like, acrobatic, because these games were, you know, all about acrobatic stuff like that, you'd want to be able to pole vault with it and use it to sort of, like, brace your fall when you're dropping down a chasm or something like that kind of thing. In which case, it'd need to be at least twice the character's height, and then you've got, you know, kind of a mixture of Daly's Thompson's Decathlon meets Flashback meets Rich Dangerous. And I was like, I don't know, really, I just couldn't visualize it. So I kind of put it off for a while and went off and did a few other bits and pieces. But he kept coming back to this thing. And, I, you know, say the lure of let's make another kind of Indiana Jones title or whatever was there. And I'm thinking, well, I've got to at least explore the idea. There may be something in it, but I don't know what it is. So at that point, I've been working with Billy Allison. And I'm still friends to this day. He's the loveliest chap, so generous with his time and super talented. And he'd come from the world of children's TV animation and stuff. And so he and I shared an office for a long while, and we really hit it off. And one of the things that I was amazed with was his ability to draw and animate. So I was like, and Billy was very, very willing to teach if you're interested. So I just bugged him and was like, Billy, why does your drawing look better than mine? Why does your animation look better than mine? Why does your this, that, and the other and stuff like this kind of thing? And he spent hours with me teaching me all about how to sketch, how to see three dimensions in a 2D drawing, how to, you know, put anatomy in there, but not too much anatomy. Reminds me, a lot of his stuff reminds me of 1970s British comics like Whizzer and Chips and Whoopi and that sort of stuff with big, crazy googly-eyed monsters and stuff like that kind of thing. And he drawing all of these things. And we hit it off and we were like, well, Jeremy wants to do this kind of rotoscoped, you know, man with a stick game. What's on the end of the stick, Vic? Because, of course, Vic Reeves and I out was about that point.
Great show.
And we were like, well, I don't know. Well, so we came back to my house one Tuesday evening, each of us with a bottle of Budweiser and a massive piece of paper and some pencils. We're like, right, okay, let's just write down all the things we think you can do with a stick. So we started drawing all these cartoons. So we did all of the things, the pole vault and all this kind of thing. And as the night went on, the ideas got sillier and sillier.
The more Budweiser you had, probably, yeah?
Yeah, so we had probably about 40 drawings. Like, use it as a snorkel, use it as a flute, use it, you know, poke it into this thing, throw it at that, it comes back to you and everything like that. So we'd come up with this idea of this man with a stick. So we went into Jeremy's office the following day and went, well, we've had a look at this thing and, you know, this idea of a rotoscope, realistic kind of, I suppose, pitfall kind of Indiana Jones. You're so limited, you know, in what you can do because it has to be a physical stick. And we kind of came up with these ideas, but they're just too mad, really. He went, I like that. And we're like, really? Yeah, you should make that. It's full of, like, cool stuff and everything. You can do that, can't you? And we're like, oh, bugger. We'd actually kind of, you know, shown what we could do. So we then sat down and kicked it off. So myself, I took the background art and a lot of the sort of level design sort of stuff. Billy took on all of the animation stuff. I ended up doing a few bits of sort of effects animation as well, kind of thing, under his supervision, balloons popping and stuff like that. He took on the character work. And then we had Mark Watson and John Kirkland doing all the coding for us. And we sat in a little tiny room and sent ourselves mad for about 9 months. The initial idea that Billy had for the character was there was a little green alien called Elvis, who was sort of very, very, very sort of tall and thin, because at that point, all game characters were small, square, or spherical. They were sort of Sonic the Hedgehog-sized kind of things. And there's good reason for that because of, you know, kind of how much screen height and clearance you have to keep above the characters. If they crouch down, you can crouch them into a ball and stuff like that kind of thing. But anyway, Billy wanted to take that on and came up with this idea of a character that was really, really, had this really tall and thin aspect. At one point or other, I think somebody had said, oh, you know, the alien, you think you could make it a person? So Billy changed it, and the guy was, the little guy resembled the one that was in the final game, but was kind of like Yorkshire flat cap and, you know, kind of belt and braces type.
All right.
He was there for a little while as the character. And then there was some more feedback. Could you kind of make him sort of American or something like that?
Have you still got any of that early concept kind of art and stuff?
Actually, if you go to Billy's website, BLImation, I think it is, .com, Billy's got a load of the original concepts.
Oh, wow. That'd be amazing to see, yeah.
Because I think he really enjoyed that time that we had together. And so he then developed the character that then became known as Bubba, which was this sort of like, you know, baseball cap wearing, dungaree wearing, little goofball And we cooked up some, we needed to take him to an alien planet. And we had the idea that he'd been abducted, stuck in an alien zoo, and he wanted to escape. And the device that we'd had with the stick was to make the stick an alien. So then we could legitimately have the alien come back to you. We could have the alien act. We could have the alien change size, change function, and things like that kind of thing. So we had this kind of strange kind of buddy thing where the primary object was a little character in the game. We cooked up a character of Waldo, which was this sort of alien that was to kind of Wile E. Coyote style pop up in a few set pieces in the game. And Billy just went all out with the crazy animation, inspirations from Ren and Stimpy, as well as the stuff that he was doing. So there's a lot of like Chris Faluci's stuff in all of those really crazy poses where he kind of gets electrocuted. And
It had such wonderful personality, that game. Even like in the background, seeing like, you know, eyes blinking in the bushes and like the trees that followed you along and all that kind of stuff. It was, I'd never seen anything like cartoon standard before on an Amiga.
Yeah, so that was the whole thing. So we just sort of went for it, you know, kind of thing. And I had sort of Billy supervising me on how to improve the art. And one of the challenges actually from me doing the background stuff was drawing all of that stuff in that sort of 2.5D aspect. Where you're seeing both the top of the platform and the side of it, so you're not looking just edge on like you were with Rick Dangerous. So that was kind of a bit of a technical challenge. And then the other side of it was to try and step back the amount of detail in the background, because, you know, you look at something like Rick and those early titles, you know, the whole idea is to saturate those little area of pixels with as much detail as possible and then repeat as many big carpets of pixels all across the screen. With Bubba, it was like, you know, totally wind that back, big areas of flat color to get that kind of cartoony look. So we invented this oddball puzzle game where you ended up having to work your way through. We ended up with a number of levels in there. I can remember we did build an entire one that we ditched because it was just way too obscure and too complicated, because of course when you're sort of deciding on the theme of a level, sometimes you're like, okay, then, well, it's really obvious, you've got four doors to open and four keys to get, and they'll be here, here, and here. And if you have that insider knowledge going into the game and you build it, you automatically know it. But when you start thinking at it from the point of view of the player who has none of that, even the most seemingly obvious stuff to you is really obscure. And in fact, you know, kind of thing, there are certain things I will admit now in Bubba that going back and playing it today, you kind of go, I can kind of understand that, you know. I think the level that always sticks in my mind for this was the one where you're inside the alien ship and you have to get four different aliens from different, lure them or coerce them from different sort of parts of the spaceship and get them to other doors or switches in other parts of the spaceship kind of thing across floors. And when you're designing it, all makes sense. But when you have to visualize it, knowing nothing coming into it, it's a bit of an ask, you know. So
yeah, I must admit, I use a walkthrough when I play it these days. I must admit, I do cheat a bit.
Yeah, you know, sort of thing. But it is one of those kind of things. And with a lot of these games, like when we were making Rick, we didn't realize we were making it that hard. It's only in hindsight you go, well, you know, actually addressing the Rick Dangerous difficulty question, which is something I always get asked about, was we kind of went in going, we want to make the Indiana Jones thing and full of surprises. And what we did was we took all of the sort of one hit and you're dead platforming aspect from Jet Set Willy and all those other games and married the two together. Well, of course, the thing about kind of Jet Set Willy and all those other games is that they rely on repeatable, predictable patterns. So you see a thing moving left and right on the screen, you know it's going to be moving left and right on the screen as you enter the screen, and you know it's going to be when you leave it, and it's all about your timing with respect to that. Rick Dangerous, you turn up, any one of all of these things can just kick off and kill you in an instant, and you're having to react at, you know, at lightning speed for it. So we managed to kind of give the experience of creating this spring-loaded pit of death. But in hindsight, looking back, you know, kind of a quarter of a century later, what we'd actually done was created this really crazy memory game that was disguised as a platform game, because it was all about repeating that exact precision, you know, learning by trial and error the route, or just getting lucky occasionally, and then being able to replicate that kind of thing, and then, oh, you know, and having the fast turnaround, which meant one more go. So I am you know, blessed to have entertained so many people, and grateful for all the nice things that everybody's said about Rick. I also sympathise with everybody who put their foot through the TV and hate the game for all it's worth, because it really was, you know, sort of like video game Marmite. And we've kind of made it that way because you were kind of going off what you thought you knew, you know, sort of thing.
Well, Simon, it's been amazing catching up with you. I know we're coming towards the end of our time together, so we just want to say, you know, there's a couple of guys that grew up playing your games when we were kids, and it's just amazing to get a bit of an insight into just how, you know, how these games were created. And
the innovativeness of them as well.
It's amazing you're as sane as you are today, Simon.
Well, if you ever want to hook up again another Saturday morning and go on and talk more, I'm only too happy to.
Absolutely, it's excellent. Been fascinating. If people want to keep up to date with what you're up to these days, then is there anywhere they can visit?
Okay, well, say, from Core I went to Acclaim. From Acclaim I went to EA and worked on Harry Potter. From EA I then worked at Criterion Games. And then about 2.5 years ago, left EA to join up with Alex Ward, Fiona Sperry, guys that I work with at Criterion, to form Three Fields Entertainment. And Three Fields, we're a very, very tiny little company based down at Petersfield in Hampshire. And it's kind of creating new but fun games that are, you know, I've got their heart in the arcades and all of the sort of stuff that we grew up with. Coming back to this, I'm now working from my home up here in Derbyshire, pretty much full time. I pop down and see those guys, but I've now got the free rein to basically shape my job however I like. So I'm in a situation where I have done bits and pieces of programming, and I'm certainly doing a load of logic scripting now in Unreal. I'm doing artwork and stuff like that kind of thing. So the game that we have just shipped was Dangerous Golf, which came out on Xbox, PS4 and PC, in which you play a game of golf indoors, smashing up stuff with loads and loads of physics, really high-end physics, liquid simulations and things like that. And I spent a lot of time doing lots of animation and front-end work and art for that kind of thing. And then we have just completed Lethal VR for the HTC Vive, and in which you play a VR simulation of being on a sort of high-tech FBI gun range. So that's been what I've been doing of late. So, yeah, just having an amazing time doing that. And I think on Monday I'll be putting finishes to a few finishing touches to the PSVR version of Lethal, and we're looking to what our next game will be.
Well, Simon, we'll pop notes to all your current projects in our show notes on our website as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us this week.
You're welcome.